This is KBOO Portland. We're going to just jump right into Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay tuned.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this August 3rd Monday. A big thank you to our dedicated KBOO staff who over the last few months have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick will be talking to Emery Mort, a people's historian in the streets of Portland. He's been to over 50 demonstrations these last 2 months, reporting on the Black Lives Matter George Floyd insurgency in Portland and its challenge to the Portland police and then federal troops. Desiree Helgers talks with Sarah Chivers, an adjunct professor of sociology at several universities in Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area. They discuss the challenges that adjuncts in Oregon face with the approach of this fall semester and how being a primary caregiver to children in the K-12 system intensifies challenges for women adjunct professors in particular. Jan Hawken interviews Lael Camargo, an indigenous descendant of the Yaqui and Mayo tribes from the Sonoran Desert. Lael Camargo is a transgender and gender nonconforming person who has been involved with performance art in both theater and video since 2008. Their recent efforts include work with Climate Woke, a collaborative project through the Center for Cultural Power, dedicated to producing videos and performance pieces on climate change by and for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Desiree Helgers returns to close out the program, talking with Pedro Anglada Cordero and Susan Anglada Bartley, members of Portland's Black Lives Matter resistance community, and how they turned a phone call from Ted Wheeler's re-election campaign headquarters into a YouTube video calling for Wheeler's resignation and for a 50% cut to the Portland Police Bureau budget. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We do begin our program with Bill Resnick talking to activist Emery Mort. This interview was recorded before the amazing events over the last weekend when the feds were forced out of Portland and all us protesters were celebrating. Surely Trump's drive for autocracy hit a big speed bump because Portland showed the country how, at this point, a sustained, near entirely nonviolent but large, strong, determined, and militant movement could stop Trump. But he is not going to give up, nor should we celebrate too soon. Tune in next week to this Old Mole Variety Hour for an analysis of how we won this temporary victory and what remains to be done here and across the country. And now, Bill Resnick and Emery Mort.
Emery Mort is a very active member of the Portland Police Reform Network. His function as their historian. He estimates he's been to over 50 demonstrations and near all the nighttime protests in front of the federal courthouse. When first the police and then the federal troops that Trump ordered, and they attacked the protesters with batons flying, tear gas, quote, non-lethal, end quote, weapons that badly injured many, some still hospitalized. Emery Mort's Facebook page is a capsule history of the George Floyd insurgency in Portland. We're going to talk about the epic demonstrations and protests here in Portland that have been heard around the world and the potentials these have created in Portland for sweeping police reconstruction to change how they operate, particularly with people of color, to make the police accountable, to use the money and resources now lavished on the police or effective programs to help vulnerable people, the homeless, those with mental health emergencies, people with addictions, people in the sex industry wanting to get out, also kids acting out in schools. These should not be primarily dealt with by police. We'd have a much safer and happier and successful society and peaceful and safe society if these were dealt with in other ways, all of them proven to work. First, Emory, tell us about the Police Reform Network.
So one important thing is it isn't a coalition that people join and are in. It's a network, meaning people can kind of come and go. People can kind of come to meetings, and some groups come to meetings for a little while and then they stop, or they get more interested at certain times or not. So that's an important distinction. There are groups who are consistently active in the network, and there are groups that play certain roles in the network, like Unite Oregon convened the network to begin with. So they are at the center of convening the meetings, but they're not the leader of the network, but they do play that role. So they are a leader in there.
James Offsink's group is also in there, I gather.
Yeah, Portland Forward, for sure. And AMAC has been represented, Dr. Haynes, Pacific Northwest Family Circle. But it's not we're like collecting groups. These are groups who have participated. And so it's not a coalition. It's just a network of people trying to follow and take action on police stuff. Lately, we've had people from 350 PDX and the Portland Association of Teachers and groups like Portland Metro People's Coalition, their coordinating committee, they've been very involved. It's a good amount of groups that have been
You're basically exchanging information and being able to focus. And so I guess they're sort of bringing forth ideas and having other people comment on them. It's very useful.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting way of organizing. So, Emory Mork, in the informationals you sent to the Police Reform Network, and also in your Facebook reports, you describe what was happening on the ground here in Portland in the Black Lives Matter George Floyd insurgency. For brevity, I'm going to read one, and then you can add some other observations referring to the federal attacks on the demonstrators. Emory Mork says, I quote, "This is a troop and an aircraft intelligence invasion being met with civil disobedience, peacefulness, singing and chanting, and public events, all of it." He continues, "What's the gist? As the chant goes, we do this every night from the streets. I and others, including the black folks I heard giving amazing speeches last night around midnight, they want maximum people out there with as many possible sticking around till 1 or 2 a.m. or later, at least one night, making these feds uncomfortable and standing up for black lives, getting informed and also forcing them to change. That doesn't mean you have to be out there. It means this is my sense of what we can be to encourage in terms of what has been most successful. For those attending, well, be like water. Move up, move back as fits. Listen and trust the medics and experienced people out there who will help enjoy the music, food, and drums, and stick together in commitment. Take breaks when necessary. Everyone is. Tell jokes. Appreciate the contributions people are making. Then do some chanting. Find out what equipment is needed, but even if you just have a mask, you can be a presence and very likely be 100% fine. Lots of water and food out there. People will be around offering suggestions and morale boosts from experience these past many nights. Of course, it's also gnarly as all heck out there sometimes, even for those who take precautions." So, Emory Moore, that was your report soon after the federal troops came into Portland and did some mayhem. Maybe you want to amplify those comments.
I just think it's the Police Reform Network. I think it's allowed us to just be fast and keep learning and building relationships with each other and allowing each other to be whoever they want to be as groups or whatever. But there's so much to do on policing. So it's really about having really healthy relationships because you have to be in it for the long haul. So you have to have good information. If we're going out there and just blowing our top about everything or getting things wrong, it hurts your overall fight. And that's part of the challenge. You know, you have to really keep kind of this combination of activist spirit, but also being really careful, really kind of studying it well.
And being careful about not delegitimating yourself or the struggle.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous tension around that and how that has to be done. And I guess like the St. Paul principles then begin entering there, and the extent to which they apply is another question. In fact, what exactly they are, I think.
Yeah, what I would say is that I really mix being in the street and going to City Hall and having meetings with officials and having relationships within a network where I can learn from those people. And then, you know, now studying state legislation and being active on that. So, it's, you know, what I do is kind of a mix of all of that. And then I do read a lot about the world, too. So I try to keep it in perspective of here's what other cities are having go on. I try to connect what's going on with a bigger perspective.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Moral Hour talking to Emory Mort, who estimates he's been to maybe 50 protest celebrations over the last 2 months. He's been writing about it, making a capsule history of the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd insurgency in Portland. You can read all about it. His views are on Facebook. City Councilor Joanne Hardesty thanked Emory for his work at a city council hearing last Wednesday. Emory, you not only have written about the details, you've concluded that this moment may well be a turning point. That is, it has great potentials. Tell us about it.
I think we're headed into really strange times, but yeah, I think there's still an earthquake settling out. Everything just changed with attitudes towards policing. We just entered a new era. And so it's a little hard to say how it's going to shake out, but I do think that the people have been radicalized, even in just the past week or two, a lot by so many people getting attacked physically by the police. That's a big deal. So I think there's going to be 100 moving parts just in terms of how groups are interacting with one another and with the issues. There's a lot of important conversations to be had. It's sort of like a dam just burst. The dam that was holding was, you could never talk about defunding the police or having abolitionist goals. Like, that was just taboo. But the dam just broke. All the dam is just spewing all over the place, and all the water's, you know, going and settling into a new place. And then the new ecosystem is going to grow out of that new river or lake or whatever it is. And it's going to be happening during COVID. It's going to be happening during a massive economic devastation. It's going to be happening while there's probably a difficult transition of power and a lot of right-wing attacks as Trump, you know, maybe leaves office. So there's so many dynamics. It's hard to go out there and say, oh, people need to, you know, show up to the city hall and do this. You know, we don't know what it's going to look like, you know, even. So I just try to keep that open mind, because I would never have expected about 10 of the things that have happened in the past 4 or 5 months to happen. And so... Yeah, we got to be prepared. You know, we got to do a lot of good, healthy talking with one another. But what I'm just excited about is the energy that's been out there. And it's like our society hit a new, like an electron in a cell. It went up to it, or an electron went up to its new orbital. It took a quantum leap. We're in a new place now. Different things. People are willing to say and do and think and feel different things. So that's exciting. It's certainly and probably one of the most core human feelings, which is empathy. White people basically being willing to address white supremacy, like, that's huge. So unfortunately, things are so time crunched right now. You know, people have the climate change staring down the barrel at them and all these things. So I wish we could have, like, gotten to this point, like, you know, we kind of did, like, 50 years ago or something, and solved it then. But I don't know, it's just going to be a wild ride. I have no idea if it's going to turn out well, but I am grateful that I've been able to witness the U.S. people and the Portland people and Oregon people do what they've just done for the past couple of months. It's clearly been one of the most incredible times in U.S. history.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Emory, when you talk about defunding the police, I have the sense that it's more productive, I think you agree too, to talk about defunding and then replacing and using the money to instead of having police handling of all sorts of what's called public safety problems, but are better seen really as the problems of people in trouble at vulnerable points in their life who really need help. It shouldn't be police. There are so many other ways of doing it that are better. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, the culture within the policing profession is very problematic. It's not a culture of accountability. It's not a culture of anti-racism. So the whole defund the police thing is kind of an emergent phrase. And emergent phrases, people don't think them through. It's an uprising and phrases come out. Defund the police, what it really means is we're done with saying, oh, let's tinker with this culture. No, it's basically a statement. Defund the police is a statement that we're not tinkering with these cultures anymore. We need to restrain their ability to harm us. We need to get them under control, take their piece of the pie that largely we've carved out for them politically and socially, and we need to help poor areas by investing in people who are in poverty. We're done tinkering around. Let's go. We're done with that era. Here's a new era. You know, and I suggest that people don't get caught up too much in the words, but more in the essence of what politically can be done. No one's saying, I don't want my neighbors to be safe, but we're a creative society. Can we not accomplish a safe, healthy society without all these extremely problematic cultures of armed men running around with no accountability? I mean, we're heading in the right direction, and I just focus on like the essence of what people are wanting and saying versus whatever phrase happens to pop up and like getting hung up on that, you know, cognitively. The energy is there. You know, people's hearts are there. That's what's important.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour talking to Emory Mort, who estimates he's been into maybe 50 protest celebrations over the last couple of months, and you can find his observations on Facebook. Emory, I have two more issues to bring up, one on the police and how you see police culture developing, and second, what sorts of organizations we want to see replacing the police in dealing with that huge range of human troubles. First, Emory, on the police. I think they're not born cruel, punitive, violent. That has to do with the job our elites have given them. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I saw someone on Twitter describe the mindset of police officers very well. It's largely run by emotion. Yeah, I don't get into, oh, these are bad people. I don't think that's really a productive way to interact with human beings in general. But yeah, it's obviously the culture is very problematic that develops in police bureaus all over, certainly the U.S. and in many places where the U.S. trained their police bureaus. Yeah, they run on emotion, they run on self-pity, they run on self-justification. And yeah, modern police forces have evolved out of past police forces. And I recommend people read Stuart Schrader's recent book, Badges Without Borders. It really is a look at how U.S.-based policing was the stuff that we know now. It was all developed in the 50s and 60s to basically massacre and put down any attempts at social democracy or communism around the world, especially in the what's called the Third World at that time. And so their emotionality and their particularities about police culture really needs to be looked at through that lens. Clearly, it's the culture that needs to be addressed. That's some of how I look at police culture, I guess.
Let's discuss the programs we create to replace the police. Is there much talk in the Police Reform Network about that question of how we want our replacement programs for police to operate?
Yeah, I just saw from Urban League and their current executive director, Nikenge Harmon Johnson, Urban League and some other black-led groups put out a kind of vision for Black Oregon. I don't have the title off the top of my head, but they just put that out like yesterday or 2 days ago. So I'd recommend people check that out. Definitely groups are addressing that question. I mean, how many people in this city do work and effort around houselessness? There's a huge ecosystem of people doing work there, and so they're thinking about alternatives to policing. And then you have that turn into Joanne Hardesty. Commissioner Hardesty is elected out of the organizing spaces. She is then managing to shepherd through the introduction of Portland Street Response, which is kind of like Cahoots and Eugene, which is getting police out of the business of dealing with people who are in poverty or who are in social isolation or all these kinds of things. So getting back to what we were talking about with the culture of police, things like violence interruption programs. The city could and does invest in some violence interruption programs. There are great people working in those spaces attempting to address violence. And the police use their resources to develop all sorts of relationships and networks in those spaces. So they try to make themselves essential everywhere. Schools, the train. They're everywhere because they're the solution to everything in this society. So now we're at this watershed moment. Everyone's like, oh, you're not the solution to everything. But it's going to take a long time to deal with all these built up relationships and ideologies. And so it's different in all sorts of scenarios what the sort of path forward is. But ideally, we would live in a society where intellectuals can coordinate with the grassroots to improve society. That's possible in a healthy society, but we currently have a society crumbling that can't accomplish hardly anything, can't even solve a virus or, you know, give people money to pay rent or develop revenue at the state level so that our threadbare social programs don't just collapse under the weight of this omni-crisis. So we have lots of potential, but we're kind of at this time where people are now just waking up, and I'm learning too. I don't have some perfect path of radicalism or something. So we're all just like, wow, what's possible now? And do we need armed people giving people traffic tickets? I'm not sure. You know, same thing with the train. Why do people have to pay money to be on the train? And then we have to have security all over the train. There's endless scenarios like this. So we could vastly improve our society if we could address this long-standing ideological hegemony of police. But yeah, everyday people, there's lots of everyday people could do to get involved. The government could invest in jobs for people to help with all of these problems. All of them. But, you know, they're clinging to capitalism. They kill the Bernie Sanders campaign. They kill the popular demands of 60 or 70% of the people. And so we're left with this uprising, and we'll see if we can remake society. I have no idea, because at the same time, society is really, really, really threadbare. There's some real problems going on.
Yeah, at least we can build all sorts of models so that when more people wake up, we'll have a much better idea of what to do.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's happening now.
It's kind of like if the earthquake hits Portland and takes out all the bridges, you know, it'd be nice to have like a bunch of boats built to help people out. But if you're not prepared, you're not prepared. We should have built the models before. You need to invest in these things. Society hasn't done that. It's the decision of our stupid leaders and our stupid systems. And, you know, even if we get through this, we're going to really, really pay for it hard these next few years. And then climate change is going to be super devastating. So building the models is nice, but it would have been nice to start doing that 50 years ago with climate change and everything else. But I still have some hope, but it's good to be realistic about the chances, I guess.
Really great talking to you.
Yeah.
Emery Mark, thanks a lot for talking.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you, Bill. I got to know the Old Mole Variety Hour not all that long ago, and I really appreciate you and all the producers on the show who have kept it going and made it possible. And yeah, look forward to talking with you in the future.
The feeling's mutual. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Around complaining about the way your life has wound up. Think of all the time you're wasting. Time's a precious thing to let go by. Sure, you've hit the bottom, but remember you'll be building from the ground up. Every day's another step that takes you even closer to the sky. So give it a try.
Next on The Old Mole, Desiree Helliger's talks with Sarah Chivers.
For this segment today, my guest is Sarah Chivers. Sarah has a PhD in sociology from Washington State University. And for more than a decade, she's adjuncted at universities and community colleges throughout the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area, including at WSU Vancouver, Portland State University, Chemeketa, and Pacific University. She teaches courses in intersectional sociology, methods of social research, community development, and community organizing. She's a member of the Oregon Educational Association local chapter of faculty at Chemeketa and the American Federation of Teachers local chapter of part-time faculty at Portland State. She's a primary caregiver for two sons who are enrolled in the Beaverton School District. Sarah, thanks so much for making time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Desiree. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so you're really in the crosshairs of three kind of unfolding crises, one in higher ed, one in K-12 education, and the other with respect to childcare. So while it's looking like universities and schools in Washington State are moving online in the fall, the situation in Oregon is a lot more ambiguous, and you know the governor has issued parameters that leave school districts as to whether or not to open up in person or to go online. So for academics with children in K-12, the situation is particularly complex and baffling, but especially so for adjuncts who, in the best of times, are treated as disposable workers and whose normal working conditions and pay are already outrageously exploitive, are likely to be among the first casualties of budget cuts in the coming months. So can you talk a little bit about some of the intense and enhanced pressures that adjuncts, and especially adjuncts who are caregivers, are facing right now?
There's so much gray area everywhere. The rules are constantly changing for our work, for everything. And it's labor 24/7. It's continuously going from taking care of kids to prepping courses to taking trainings on how to do online delivery or universal design learning. So it's really exhausting physically and emotionally to just be managing all that at the same time without there really being much structure or predictability as to what's going to happen in the future.
And that kind of additional stress makes you more vulnerable to health issues.
It's really disheartening to think about the thousands of adjuncts in the state of Oregon who work part-time at multiple institutions and who've accumulated full-time teaching hours and then some, you know, teaching a full-time load, but not really being compensated as full-time workers and not having access to healthcare. It's scary because there's a lot of consequences to not having health care during a pandemic.
Who's in the worst position across the board is, you know, the adjuncts who are running from campus to campus, risking exposure at, you know, multiple sites.
Some of us teach on campuses and communities that are hot spots that, you know, rely on essential workers who don't have health care.
Has Portland State made a decision yet about what they're going to do in the fall?
We continue to be barraged by emails with rollout plans, and ultimately it's the governor that makes the calls, and the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Department of Education are working together. But as you highlighted, there's so much flexibility in how schools and school districts can approach things. At first, a lot of schools sounded like they were going to offer hybrid models, but now it sounds like we're going all online through November, and many of us realists are just planning on the whole school year being online, both K through 12 and in higher education. There's a group of educators online who've worked really hard the last couple of weeks pushing for 14 days of no new COVID cases before any face-to-face, person-to-person learning happens at all. And I think that they put a lot of pressure on the governor and are doing it. And the union leadership is just catching up to that. So it's really going to be interesting to see what happens over the next 2 weeks as the disaster spread in Florida and Texas.
It's kind of disturbing. There's a lot of pressure to be developing materials to teach in, you know, one format or the other. At the same time, as we're looking at the potential for draconian budget cuts in higher ed, you are facing the possibility of being the first laid off.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a paradox. I mean, everybody needs to learn. Communities need resources that are frequently distributed through colleges and K through 12 public schools, but we are so under-resourced. In Oregon, we've been under-resourced for years, but it just continues to get worse and worse. And you know, all the extra hours of labor that teachers are doing and learning these new software platforms and learning programs, they're changing constantly. And our students aren't going to be able to keep up with this. Our students don't have the resources to do this because before the pandemic, students are dealing with issues of food insecurity, houselessness, and their own, you know, access to healthcare and resources. It's ridiculous. I'm waiting for more parents and teachers to be as disturbed by the situation as I am. But I think it's going to take some more community conversations.
Okay, and also, I mean, the issues of food insecurity and houselessness really are impacting many adjuncts, even pre-pandemic, right? And we're looking at, what, about 30% of renters nationwide have been unable to make their rent this month, and we're looking at the potential for an enormous wave of evictions that might also affect many adjuncts.
You know, I have colleagues, friends who are adjuncts who are math professors teaching at our local community college and state-funded university who can't afford to rent their own home, that have to rent a bedroom out of someone else's house to survive. They're teaching to 9 classes per year at various places, and they don't even have health care. It's McUniversity. It's how can we get the most from students, paying the most, funding the least, as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And, you know, students and adjuncts, we classified employees, we are at the bottom of the ivory tower. There's tremendous consequences and implications for what's happening at warp speed with very few resources. And kids are really losing out. We're going to see a generation of kids dealing with what our school systems and our legislators are putting us through as parents, teachers, right now.
I think that goes to the question of sort of income inequality in both K-12 and higher ed. And, you know, I'm most familiar with those conditions in higher ed and the fact that, you know, we have adjuncts who are making a pittance per class while we have many administrators, certainly on the Washington side of the river, who are making in excess of the governor's salary. So we have enormous concentration of wealth and enormous salaries at the top from administrators, but they're not at the same kind of risk of exposure in the classroom.
Just from looking at recent salary data for administrators across, you know, public universities and colleges in Oregon and Washington, there are at least a dozen administrators at each school that make what an adjunct makes in a year, an administrator makes in 1 month. Huge disparities in how student tuition dollars and state funding is distributed to people who are trying to educate and build knowledge for community empowerment.
How can concerned listeners help with this?
Well, if you're an adjunct and you are not a member of a union, I would say, you know, reach out. There's a number of different options for part-time faculty, for full-time faculty. There are even unions for unemployed workers. I would say connecting with another adjunct and really understanding what's happening on the ground is really important too. Adjuncts are very isolated from each other, and that's part of the challenge of organizing. We come to and from our courses and we spend lots of contact time with students, but we really don't have a community. So we need to work hard as adjuncts to build that community. You know, there's roles for everyone to play. Students, we really want to build student success as much as possible. So building coalitions and relationships with our students is really vital in order to make education more equitable. I'd say, you know, in the short term, we need to put the fire to our legislators. There's not a lot of progress being made about healthcare issues. There's very little about legislators wanting to cap or minimize how much administrators can make. So I think, you know, in terms of legislation, those are two really important pieces, making sure that educators have healthcare and making sure that universities are distributing their revenue in equitable ways that support student learning and success is really vital.
And that last part really involves all legislative cap to administrative salaries, right? To make
sure
that we don't have this kind of gross inequality within the university system. So Sarah, thank you so much for talking with me today. My guest today has been Sarah Chivers, and she's an adjunct professor at sociology who's been working for the past decade within the Vancouver, Portland metropolitan area. Sarah, thanks again.
Thank you.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Oldmore Variety Hour.
Climate Woke, a new series of social-friendly videos, highlights the experiences of the frontline communities most impacted by climate change and environmental devastation. The Big C, a video produced by Climate Woke members, there is no climate justice without labor justice. The exploitation of working people is connected to the devastation of our planet and our communities, but when we fight back, we win. Following the Big C, Jan Hocken talks with producer Lyle Camargo, who uses satire, comedy, and critical hope to amplify the realities of those facing the brunt of the climate crisis and offers collective solutions for a more sustainable future. And now, the Big C.
I'm here to spill the beans on the Big C. Fellas don't think it's real. Us ladies can't even talk about it. And for everyone in between and whatnot, forget about it. We can't even admit we have a Big C. But lucky for you, I'm here to help. I know everything that has to do with the big climate crisis. The climate crisis is a result of a highly abundant resource that is constantly extracted. Most people think that this resource is fossil fuels. In reality, it's not. This resource is people. This is Rita. Instead of using her labor to meet her basic needs, Rita ends up selling her labor to someone else who decides what to do with her time. Like most workers, Rita's boss decides what work she does, even if this work harms her body, the planet, and everything else that lives on it. Oh, and the cherry on top? Rita's boss doesn't pay her a living wage. Meanwhile, Rita is stuck in a cycle of trying to make money just to make ends meet. This exploitation is possible because of the lie that one group of people are worth more than others. And by taking ourselves and our labor out of the equation when talking about climate change, we perpetuate a twisted fairy tale that this planet and its people are here to exploit. That life, soil, water, and air are here to package, sell, consume, and dispose of. It's a consequence of the exploitation of labor that is used to extract fossil fuels. To get to the root of the problem, we first have to address social inequity in our relationship as people to the living world. Climate change is something that we'll have to weather together. We have to reclaim our labor in all of its diverse forms that celebrate our different bodies, cultures, and ways of living on planet Earth. It's not about going back. It's about remembering our way forward. It's about working together to solve the Big C.
Welcome to KBOO, Lyle Camargo.
Hi.
Hi. Well, we're happy to have you with us today to talk about your work. We just heard The Big C, produced by you and your collaborators at the Center for Cultural Power. And I must say it's as beautiful to watch The Big C as a video, which is available, as it is enchanting to hear as radio. So tell us about the analysis behind this piece and what you're trying to say about labor and the climate crisis.
Yeah, first off, thank you for having me. The Big C was born out of collaboration with an amazing activist. His name is Gopal Dayanani, and in collaboration with an amazing climate activist as well as actor and singer, Antonique Smith. And the reason why we went with the idea of making the connections between labor in the climate justice movement is because we're definitely at a fork right now where climate change is not going to get resolved strictly by fossil fuel divestment, strictly by renewable energy investment, but it is going to require a large societal shift. A lot of our young and amazing activists are making connections between racial disparity, class disparity, abilities, and the impacts that those frontline marginalized communities have in the climate crisis. So why we targeted The Big C to focus on labor is because the reality is we have a labor exploitation problem, which is gathering the accumulation of wealth and power between the people who are the 1%. And it isn't until we start to reclaim our labor and start disrupting the exploitation that is happening that we will really get ahead of any possibility of climate change ever being an issue in the future. It's the devaluing of humans that causes the accumulation of labor exploitation by a certain group of people.
I think it's the most brilliant, by far, a short application of Marx's labor theory of value that I've mm-hmm. seen. It's funny, it's beautiful, and it in everyday terms explains this idea of extracting a surplus. That's the basis of capitalism and profits, is extracting a surplus from labor. And I think many in the movement now have been taking up extractive industries that exploit the planet and for maximizing of profits. But I think you bring in this other theme, this level of analysis that's so important about extraction of a surplus profit throughout the history of capitalism, mm-hmm. of primarily working class people, but brown and black people, indigenous people, and their lands and labor, and that this is a structural problem within capitalism at the center of the climate crisis.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think it's a time where we can't keep just talking about polar ice caps melting or the extinction of natural resources, which is a very important conversation to have. But we also need to talk about, you know, our brothers and sisters at the front lines who are, for lack of better words, in positions of employment that are damaging the planet, but not to any fault of their own. A lot of it has been systemically organized, and not all of us have access to Marxist theory, and not all of us have access to academic language or academic reading. So we went with the big C because we wanted it to be digestible. We wanted it to be understanding for everybody, and we wanted it to be fun and entertaining. We didn't want to make something about climate change that we keep seeing, which is gloom and doom narratives. For myself, I kind of nerd out on a lot of documentaries, but for many people, our lives are already difficult. And when we sit down and we want to scroll through social media, we want to see stuff that either brings us joy or that, you know, makes us feel a little bit more stimulated. So the big C was a good way for us to continue pushing for fossil fuel extraction to be more than just about divestment against fossil fuels, but to actually be about the reclamation of labor and moving towards community cooperation and collaboration, which is what we're going to need to survive this crisis together.
And I think the video plays very cleverly on the idea of something very big. It's the big elephant in the room that's hard to talk about. That there's a taboo or anxiety around it as well, and that for marginalized groups, historically, humor has been an important weapon of resistance.
That's right.
And a lot of the traditions of comics, comedians, come out of groups that have suffered oppression or prejudice. So how do you draw on, as also someone who identifies with marginalized and has a history of marginalization, how do you think about the role of humor in the climate movement?
I think a lot of what drives how we approach these narratives, and the big C doesn't have a huge comedy component, but there are two additional climate woke videos that are out there. One's already been released that plays more in the comedy field. Is myself as a transgender, gender nonconforming, first generation American. My mother is a descendant of an indigenous tribe from the Sonoran Desert. I grew up experiencing colorism, being impacted by classism, coming out as queer, coming out as transgender was a big struggle. And what a lot of us have learned to survive on is being able to gather with people of similar experiences and being able to laugh at the end of the day around what we do to release. And so as someone who comes from marginalized communities, laughter and joy is something that has to be strongly cultivated. I look at the Black community a lot for my work because of the history in this country, and the oppression that Black people have experienced has really driven how we want people to talk about climate change. We don't want it to be about moving from a place of shame and guilt, which white supremacy has indoctrinated us in that. We want to move from a place of joy and possibility. And that's only possible through fun, through the arts, through cultural activation. And a lot of the work that we work on with Climate Woke is around that. How do we gather people together around the possibility of a future, which is honestly really difficult to do in the environmental movement, because you look at the data, you look at the the dropping rates of certain populations of plants and animals, and the extinction rates are going up, and we ourselves are getting closer to that. And now with we're in a global pandemic, which to no fault of many of us, we're all being impacted by it, similarly to climate change. And so being able to find joy and pleasure and being able to laugh at the end of the day, as ridiculous as it sounds when it feels like the whole world's falling apart, literally, I think is very important because we are a very creative, smart, intuitive, loving species. And I don't think we get enough credit for what we can do because we're so tied up to the 9-to-5. Most of us do not have the privilege of even having weekends off because it's so expensive to live. And, you know, the systems have been created that way so that we stay in our jobs. So I think the Big C, what it's really trying to do is also push for the fun and the joy and the possibility. One of the comments that I got after it was released was, what you're saying here at the end is not possible. And I just thought, wow, the imagination of people is just so dim, and that's strategic. So that makes me feel like I'm doing a good job if I'm making somebody question or really face their thoughts and that they're being vocal about it. I'm glad that that person made that comment because I hope other people see it and they're like, is it possible? Is it not possible?
You mean that criticism suggested that your project or your analysis is too utopian?
Yes, too utopian. And I think that the thing is what we are pushing for, we see people doing. It's just people haven't seen that. There's a lot more mobilization around land reclamation. There's reparations happening. We've been seeing a return of land to indigenous communities. So I actually feel like what we are, our vision is now. It's happening. And being able to approach all of that with pleasure and joy and lots and lots and lots and laughter is going to help us there. What made us move towards comedy, because we were initially doing Man on the Streets, but what made us move towards comedy is we met an amazing academic, and she told us that the best way to do problem solving is if somebody's laughing, and that studies have proven this in psychology over and over. That to me made me think, all right, let's have fun. Let's really, I was holding back, but then it's like, let's just have fun. I mean, it's about doing it in a respectful way where everybody feels like their voices are still being heard while things are being laughed and processed.
And I wrote an article years back on drag and called What's So Funny, and made a film about the role of humor for straight audiences and why they find drag funny. And it became a question of who pays the price of the joke? What's being laughed at? Is it gender codes? Is it laughing at gay men, straight women? And I think that question of who pays the price of the joke, how to use humor as a weapon against the dominant industries that are destroying so much of life on the planet. So there's both humor as a kind of acknowledgement of the absurdity of situations, of the importance of pleasure, even in the midst of a lot of suffering. But there's also humor as a political weapon against ruling elites. Would you align yourself with that tradition of humor as a political weapon, as opposed to a way of reclaiming joy and amidst tremendous suffering?
Oh, yes, most definitely. And before I go into it more, the person who I'm naming who really inspired us to move forward is Katie Borum, who's an academic, and she wrote a book called A Comedian and an Activist Walk into a Bar. I recommend it for folks who are activists. And to go back to what you're saying is comedy and joy and laughter and pleasure are essential in times of revolution, in times of systemic change. And I align myself very, very much with that is a form of resistance. And because when our lights get dim, when we get so caught up in the reactionary of what is happening, which is important, we are just tapped into our survival. And we are left without an option of thinking through what's an imaginative or a creative or a radical possibility in the future. And it's the balance of two that actually is so necessary for the work that we do. And as somebody who was a former organizer in transformative justice, I think this has been a big influencer to my work, is that we can't focus on abolishing certain systems like fossil fuel extraction, certain governmental systems that aren't working, and not building something new, because what we're going to be left with is a lot of sorrow, a lot of grief, a lot of needing to react to something that we might actually perpetuate that from continuing those systems to be continuing for us to be stuck in a fighting mode. And what climate change is showing us is that climate change is a symptom to a bigger problem. And the biggest problem is the inequity in our systems and our societies. And it isn't until we address the racial disparities, the class disparities, the gender disparities, the disparities in the impacts that we have on communities that are disabled, that we won't be able to eradicate certain symptoms like climate change.
In closing, tell listeners how they can find your work and learn more about the Center for Cultural Power, as well as the Big C video and other works.
Yeah, so you can follow us on at Culture Strike on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The videos are on our Instagram TV, on Culture Strike's handle, and the most recent release video is called The Power to Rely On, which looks at Native Indigenous women on both Hopi and Navajo Nation around what they're doing around renewable energy. That one's a little bit more funnier than The Big C, and you can watch The Big C on there too. And if you are interested in continuing our work, you can follow us on YouTube as well. We'll be posting our next video hopefully by the end of September or by mid-October.
Well, thank you so much for your work and for being with us today, Lael Camargo. Thank you for being with us on Olmo Variety RNK Boo, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. I hope you have a good day.
We conclude today's program with Desiree Helligers talking with Pedro Anglada Cordero and Susan Anglada Bartley. They're members of Portland Black Lives Matter resistance community and recently had a little run-in with Ted Wheeler. Desiree?
So my guests for this segment are Pedro Anglada Cordero and Susan Anglada Bartley, who are members of Portland's Black Lives Matter resistance community and who are a regular presence at Occupy ICE and who run a mutual aid network, the United Mutual Network, giving food out on the 82nd Corridor. Thank you so much for joining me today. So on Thursday, you happened to get a phone call from Wheeler's reelection campaign office, and you're not really clear, it sounds like, whether that was just a random phone call, whether there were other motivations behind it, but it sounds like you ended up giving the person who called from the campaign office more than he bargained for. And it's kind of an interesting, if it is a coincidence, it's an interesting one because you've had a number of pretty public run-ins with the mayor and you've been very critical of his handling of a number of issues, particularly, I think, most recently with respect to Black Lives Matter and the police presence in Portland. Do you want to talk a little bit about what happened?
Yes, and thank you for having me and also greetings to the audience. Yes, I'm thinking that probably at some point it was really a prank call because I just don't understand that how the mayor will be willing to engage in campaigning at this point when his work around the city is essentially completely absent and non-existent. But yes.
Yeah, it actually seems like a really weird flub that their campaign called our house. What proceeded from there is Pedro kind of took him to church. I don't know what else to say.
Videotaped it on the phone and put it up on YouTube. So we will certainly link to it when we put up the segment.
Thank you.
Yes, and the reason we did that is because I think people should know about what's happening behind the scenes, you know, especially if anybody listening to this interview had received any of those calls. Basically, the mayor is very much invested in doing some damage control and mm-hmm. present some sort of facade of a victory that he has negotiated with the governor and the federal government to mm-hmm. remove the feds from the federal courthouse. Nevertheless, we were yesterday, just before we received the call, we were there in that area, and the police presence there is overwhelming.
We wanted to highlight the hypocrisy as well as the level of supremacy that they're employing. They have networks of people ready to make calls on their behalf many months before an election just to try to do that damage control. And we wanted to illustrate that they are lying about what's going on.
So he put a really positive spin on the clearing out of Chapman Square, and you had been in the park, and you saw it sounds like an enormous police presence, and you were serving iced tea. And it sounds like there were a lot of hungry, thirsty people there who've been relying on the community that had sprung up around the Black Lives Matter protests and riot ribs. And can you talk a little bit about what you saw and the need that's obviously there?
Yes. Basically, Susie and I were there between 3 o'clock and shortly after 5. Very clear that the food services that had been put in place mainly by Riot Ribs mm-hmm. Had made a positive impact in the community. And the fact that they had removed that and there's no longer there, and instead there's just a bunch of police, it says a lot.
Yeah, it's a really disgusting use of services for people to stand in a park while they're surrounded by people who are in need for medicines, in need for food, in need just for simple water, and be in that park armed while people pretending they're doing community care where on all perimeters there are people who are suffering. That's disgusting, and that's another layer of the hypocrisy. And that's exactly what we're trying to reverse with the concept of abolishing the police, defunding the police.
And so can we say, though, that there's that enormous police presence is coming at the price of money that could be going into food, that could be going into housing, and instead where it's going into bullets and cops?
That is precisely what we argue, and that's what defunding the police is about, which the mayor nor the city commissioners acted on the demands of the people. Initially, the initial demands were to cut $50 million from the budget at this point, which is way less than what we now ask, which is 50%. And if that level of money would be invested in community, be utilized by the same communities that are most affected, then we can have some change in the city. The fact that all that money is going towards the police to maintain the control in the city speaks volume about the level of disconnect this mayor has with the people he's supposed to be serving.
We really do want to lift up the Teresa Rayford mayor campaign, the People's Movement. She has been there for so many years on this issue, and she has a keen understanding of the kind of changes that need to be made. So we do want to lift that up.
We're living in a time right now. We're in the midst of a global pandemic. We are looking for new leadership. We know what Teresa is doing. Teresa is out there really working really hard to bring about a change in this city. We just don't know what everybody else is doing. You know, we know that Teresa is working, not even elected, but we just don't know what Ted Wheeler or any other candidate is actually doing. If the mayor wants to engage in further damage control, then he can resign as mayor. And that can actually help the people of the city to move forward and to allow for new leadership to step in, some new leadership that can actually bring some change.
So I've been talking to Pedro Anglada Cordero and Susan Anglada Bartley. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And again, we will link to that tape so that our listeners will be able to hear that encounter. Thanks again.
It was a
tremendously creative action.
Thank you.
That concludes our program for this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you The Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick, Emery Mort, Desiree Helger talking with Sarah Chivers this morning, Jan Hawken interviewing Lyell Camargo, video producer for Climate Woke. Desiree Helger's returning again to talk with Pedro Anglada Cordero and Susan Anglada Bartley about Black Lives Matter resistance in the community. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for tuning in.